Welcome back, everyone, to lecture 11. So last time we started the discussion of properties of conservation laws in the general sense. So for scalar equations, but also for systems of conservation laws, we essentially showed first that there's the non-existence of global classical solutions, and then we introduced weak solutions. And finally explored some properties of weak solutions across discontinuities, the so-called Rankine-Ugonio theorem. And so as announced last time, the agenda for today will be to discuss the entropy condition. And finally, I will also give a brief primer on the Riemann problem by essentially discussing a first example for scalar conservation laws, namely the Riemann problem for the Invissit-Burgers equation that already shows some sort of phenomenological behavior that we'll expect from the sort of more general cases. Okay, so the starting point essentially for the entropy condition is the realization that for weak solutions, so that weak solutions are in general not unique. And so we essentially need some sort of selection criterion that tells us what sort of the physical solution is that we are actually interested in. So let me just start by pointing this out. So in general, the initial value problem has no unique weak solution, and we'll show this in just a second by employing a simple example. Or in other words, the initial value problem for weak solutions is not well posed, by which we mean that a solution exists, the solution should be unique, and it should also depend continuously on the initial data. So what we want actually is, and this is what we will do in this section here, is to define a selection criterion . And this is referred to as the entropy condition. To pick the correct physical solution and thus restore well-posedness of the problem. So let me just start with an example to point out that weak solutions in general are not unique. So let's again invoke the sort of by now fairly well-known Invissit-Burgers equation. So let's look again at this equation where the flux is given by 1/2 u squared. And again, this is 1D, x is in R and t equal t greater than zero. And let's assume we have initial data that actually triggers a discontinuity, or that is discontinuous to begin with. And so that is already what we would call the Riemann problem for this equation. And so we can now define two piecewise differentiable solutions. So we'll show that both of them are actually weak solutions, so that we can actually write down two different solutions, two different weak solutions to this problem. So let's say, let's consider this solution for x smaller than 1/2 t and one for x greater than 1/2 t. I'll draw these in a second so things will become a little more intuitive. For now, let me just write those down. Now we can make a small modification here. And sort of at least connect these two regimes in a continuous way, if not, so not in a differentiable, but in a continuous way. And so we'll see that, so obviously both solutions are piecewise differentiable in their different parts. And they also satisfy the initial condition at t equals zero. So they satisfy this initial jump condition. So far so good. So let's concentrate on U1 first and show that it's actually a weak solution to the problem. And we'll do this by invoking the Rankine-Ugonyot theorem that we showed last time, which, as you may remember, was an if and only if statement. So meaning that if we find a solution that is piecewise differentiable and satisfies the initial conditions, and additionally it satisfies the Rankine-Ugonyot jump conditions, then it is actually, in fact, a weak solution to the problem. And so we'll invoke the theorem exactly in this way. So we already know that it's piecewise differentiable. And now we'll just check the Rankine-Ugonyot jump conditions and thus infer that it's actually a weak solution. So U1 satisfies the jump conditions along the discontinuity sigma that we parameterize again in the same way as introduced last time, sigma of t comma t with sigma of t given by 1/2 t. And let's see how this arises. So we have sigma prime of t equals 1/2. Set sort of by construction. And now we'll check that f of u left of the left state minus the flux evaluated at the right state divided by ul minus ur actually is 1/2 UL squared. So that's the flux for the inviscid Burgers equation minus 1/2 U right squared divided by UL minus UR is 1/2 U left plus U right. And so this is, so from here we deduce the shock speed as equal to 1/2. So this means that U1 is in fact a weak solution to the problem. So let me just try to draw this a little bit. So the solution looks like this. We have again x and t here, and we have this discontinuity that sort of travels at the shock speed one half to this direction. And so here we have characteristics. Oops, sorry. Should. Plot this a little steeper. So here we have characteristics that have slope one. And so here we have characteristics that just follow straight lines here. Now we can check that also U2 satisfies the Rankine-Ugoniot condition and therefore represents a weak solution to the problem. So for U2, can check it satisfies the jump conditions. Along the two domain boundaries between the sort of piecewise differentiable parts of the solution. So sigma one parameterized by t comma t. And sigma two of t comma t. Zero comma t. So the picture is the following. So we have one domain boundary here, sigma two, and then we have one here, sigma one. And again, so if we draw the characteristics, would look like this. So we have this kind of fan here in the middle, and then again, straight lines here. So here we have characteristic speeds, lambda two equals U two equals zero. Here we have lambda one. Let's call this just lambda over here. U1, and then in here the characteristic speed depends on x over t, so lambda is given by, sorry, here we have one actually, and so here we have, here U2 is x over t. All right, and so one can, in a very analogous way, one can verify that. I won't explicitly do it here because it's almost trivial that U2 also satisfies the jump conditions along sigma one and sigma two, and therefore also represents a weak solution. And so the simple example essentially illustrates that in general, the weak solutions are not unique, and for a given problem, we can have more than one solution. Now, in reality, it turns out that physically we would only see discontinuities as sort of some idealization that is not in nature really truly sharp, or as sharp as we sort of mathematically describe it by this discontinuity. But it's these discontinuities are rather sort of smeared out somewhat, at least, by some sort of viscosity of the fluid, at least some residual viscosity of the fluid. So in principle, one would expect those discontinuities essentially to arise from such a sort of more regularized or say viscous system with some residual viscosity. And so these shocks to be sort of some idealization of solutions that arise from those systems. And this is exactly the idea behind the so-called viscosity method. So let me just write this down. So in reality, arbitrarily sharp, but rather smeared out by some intrinsic viscosity. So one would expect the physically correct solutions, so to say, to arise the actual conservation law to arise as sort of idealized limit of a system containing viscosity. Correct solutions should arise as the limit of a regularized system of this form, where now we have a parameter, where we introduce a viscosity parameter epsilon. We introduce a second spatial derivative here. A viscous term where we set this term to be small, and we want to look at solutions of this system as epsilon goes to zero, i.e. as the problem approaches the inviscid limit. And this is essentially what gives rise to what's called the viscosity method. And this method is really rooted in the following theorem. And so the statement is that, let's say we have some essentially bounded initial data, U naught. So that's in L infinity. Also actually has to be integrable. So the And let's say we have some flux functions fi and some term b, which I'll define in a second. Let's assume that these functions are actually continuously differentiable continuously differentiable. And whose derivatives are bounded. Then for any epsilon greater than zero, there exists uniquely defined classical solution. So continuously differentiable solution U epsilon of the system of this form that contains a viscosity parameter. So we have a system of conservation laws and so we also have the source term B and we have a viscosity parameter epsilon in here. And we have some initial data U naught. And this solution is such that U epsilon converges to some function U. Let me actually highlight this in red. Almost everywhere, so except for a subset of measure zero. And that solution U, so that limit U is actually a weak solution of the inviscid problem. Some U that is a weak solution, also referred to as the viscosity limit of the inviscid problem, which is written in this form. Equal zero, and again, same initial data. So this is a very important theorem. We are not going to prove it here. And the reason is twofold. So one is obviously that this would be fairly technical and would sort of sidetrack us a little bit from our sort of more exploratory approach here. And second, we will show a similar theorem on the discretized level. So we'll focus on sort of the formalism on the discretized level when we discuss actual numerical algorithms. So here we are not too interested in the result on the sort of continuous level. So for now, I will skip the proof here, but it's actually an important result because it establishes the existence of a weak solution for the inviscid problem. And it tells us that there exists such a viscosity limit for such a problem. So a weak solution that can be obtained as the viscosity limit of the problem with viscosity, for which we actually have a sort of continuous series of classical solutions that are differentiable and that converge almost everywhere to this weak entropy solution. And that is actually very useful. So now that we have established the existence of such a viscosity limit of such a weak solution. What we would actually like to know in practice is whether a given solution, whether a given weak solution that we may be able to write down actually represents such a viscosity limit, meaning that it can actually be obtained from taking such a viscosity limit of a viscous problem. So this will be our next step. So we want the necessary criterion for a weak solution U to be the viscosity limit. And for this, I would have to first make two definitions. And so this will now introduce the concepts of a so-called entropy or entropy flux pair. So the first definition is following two smooth functions let's call them phi and psi that are twice continuously differentiable. Are called an entropy flux pair. I will just call them entropy pair in the following for the system of conservation laws UT plus F of U X equals zero. If the following two conditions are satisfied, phi is a convex function, meaning that the Hessian is positive definite everywhere. So D2 psi applied to y times y equals greater than zero for all z and y in Rm. And then second, we also require that the following identity holds, that the Jacobian of psi times the Jacobian of the flux of the conservation law equals d psi everywhere. And so these conditions will become a little clearer in just a couple of minutes when we'll be doing a few calculations with these entropy pairs. So for now, this is just a sort of an abstract definition for an entropy pair. And let me just add another definition here. Now we define what we mean by an entropy solution. A weak solution U of the initial value problem is called an entropy solution. If for any entropy pair phi and psi, it satisfies the following inequality. Meaning that phi of U plus psi of u x smaller than smaller equal zero in the domain where the solution u to the initial value problem is defined. And we require this in the distributional sense. Which means that if we integrate this condition here, if we integrate this over the entire domain and we integrate by parts, assuming for now that u is say a classical solution just for now, we integrate by parts, and then we can sort of reshuffle the integral into the following form, and we'll use that as a definition for the general case. So we'll transfer again the derivatives to test functions, as we did in the case of the actual definition of a weak solution. So we'll have this expression, dx by dt, and partial integration by parts will actually change the direction of the inequality sign here. And so this is for all test functions v with compact support on our domain r cross 0 to infinity. And also we're assuming here that these test functions are positive, so as to not change the inequality sign. Okay, and now comes sort of the key insight and the sort of key statement, which we'll formulate as a theorem. The viscosity limit that we just defined above and whose existence was established by the previous theorem of the viscous problem actually represents a entropy solution in the sense of the definition that we just gave. So this is at t equals zero. So this is an entropy solution. Of the inviscid problem. Provided that now we have to make some sort of reasonable assumptions, namely that we assume that all u epsilon uniformly bounded essentially everywhere, and that they also fall off sufficiently rapidly as we go to spatial infinity here, So we'll see that this is some details required for some of the integrals to vanish. Okay, and so this is essentially the key insight that the viscosity method leads to an entropy solution, and that we have a sufficient criterion to check whether or not a given weak solution is actually an entropy solution. Namely, for any entropy pair, we'll need to show that the solution satisfies this condition here, or if we show this in the distributional sense, we essentially have to verify that the solution satisfies this property here. And this gives us a sufficient criterion, according to this theorem, that we've actually identified the correct sort of physical solution to the problem. And by the way, entropy pair, so the naming, sort of the idea behind this is that it will turn out that for sort of some physical problems, like in hydrodynamics, a entropy pair is actually given by the entropy itself, so by the physical thermodynamic entropy and the entropy flux. So those actually represent a entropy pair in the definition of that we've just given here for in the context of the Euler equations. So essentially, what the entropy condition does in the case of the Euler equations, and this is something that you will show on one of the following problem sets, is that it essentially tells the Euler equations about the sort of second law of thermodynamics, namely that the entropy, as shown here, is never supposed to to decrease, but that it either is conserved or it is it can actually increase in shocks, as we'll see. So essentially, this is just adding some additional information to the Euler equations about thermodynamics that the conservation laws themselves don't know about, and this essentially helps to identify then the correct physical solution that also, in this case, respects some sort of basic laws of thermodynamics. Okay, and I would actually like to go through this proof fairly quickly because it is not too technical, not too long, but and also gives a nice sort of overview of how to use these entropy conditions and some of the tricks involved here, making use of the fact that we can actually differentiate the solution U epsilon as long as we are sort of some finite part away from the actual entropy solution. So this should also hopefully provide some ideas on how to use those entropy conditions that you may be using in some of the following problems on the problem set. Okay, so the first step is just to consider really any arbitrary entropy pair for a weak solution U to the inviscid problem. And then let's write down the viscous problem. Now this here can be sort of re-expressed as df, again, making use of the fact that U epsilon is actually C1 as long as epsilon is finite. And so we can rewrite this in this way. And let's multiply this with the Jacobian here of phi. So then, again, we can rewrite this as phi of u epsilon t plus psi of u epsilon x equals epsilon d phi u epsilon u xx epsilon, which we can also write in as epsilon phi of u epsilon xx minus epsilon, and then we have here the Hessian of psi times ux epsilon times ux epsilon. And now we know that this part is greater than zero. So this whole, this entire term, by definition of the entropy pair, because phi is convex, so that was part of the definition of the entropy pair. Now let's multiply this equation by some test function with, again, compact support. And then we integrate, and so we'll have the following. Phi of u epsilon t v plus psi u epsilon x v dx dt. Now everything is smooth in here, so we can integrate by parts. And so we find that this is phi of u epsilon times v, where we've integrated over time already. And so here we have psi of u epsilon times v, where we've integrated over space. And we just write down the other term. And so here we have the expression where we reshuffle the derivatives to the test function. Now these two integrals are actually zero because these test functions have compact support and thus vanish at infinity, or zero in the case of the time domain. And so we can rewrite this expression in the following form. So starting with the latter term, and now noting that these expressions are zero, and using the fact that this part here will be given by the right hand side up here, where we're making use of the fact that this last term is actually greater or equal than zero. You can write this as greater or equal minus integral over epsilon phi of u epsilon xx v dx dt. And so where we've neglected this second term here on the right hand side, hence the inequality sign here. So this is phi is convex. And so we can again integrate this by parts two times to again move over the derivatives to the test function. Where other boundary terms vanish. And now finally, we can take the limit of epsilon goes to zero and u epsilon thus converging to the limit u, to the weak solution u, then we obtain the expression with integral over phi of u bt plus psi of u vx dx dt greater or equal than zero. But if you compare this expression actually with the definition of the entropy solution up here, you'll see this is exactly identical. So we've just shown that this limit actually represents an entropy solution. So u equals limit of u epsilon for epsilon goes to zero satisfies the entropy condition. And now we'll actually show that this limit u is also a weak solution, and hence the statement of the theorem follows. So let's start again with some test function now actually including the initial data at t equals zero. And let's multiply the viscous problem with that test function. You can integrate by parts. Everything is smooth in here so far. And obtain the following. So where we've transferred the derivative to a test function. We'll have u epsilon dotted with v with integrated over time. Now this here, actually only one term survives. Which is the initial data term, since the test function has complex support and vanishes. In this case, actually U epsilon vanishes as it falls off rapidly as x goes to zero, as x goes to spatial infinity. So we will only have this initial data term here. And then the other terms are the one containing the flux, again with the derivative shifted to the test function, and we have the viscosity limit, the viscosity term. And so all of this equals zero. So just recollecting terms, we can write this as U epsilon dot VT plus F of U epsilon dot VX plus epsilon U epsilon dot VXX. Plus the initial data term, which I'll just denote by U0 epsilon for now, equals zero. And now, again, we can take the limit epsilon goes to zero. And so we just obtain the definition of U being a weak solution to the inviscid problem. So U is a weak solution. Therefore, the theorem is proven. Okay, so this now nicely combines the notion of an entropy solution with this viscosity method. And in 1D for scalar conservation laws, one can now show that this also restores uniqueness of weak solutions. And this is just a result that I will quote and that we will not show. And this is the following, namely that there exists only one entropy solution for a given scalar conservation law. Again, in a weak sense, so a unique solution up to measure zero subset. So at most, one entropy for the scalar conservation law. So this is our initial data, and this is R across 0 to infinity. So if you're interested in a proof of this, I'll refer you to the book by Evans. It's in section 11.4.3. And the proof is rather long and technical, so it's too long to be reproduced here and would also sidetrack us here. But sort of the main statement here is obviously important. So this result essentially restores well-posedness for conservation laws, for weak solutions to conservation laws. And so I will just finish the discussion here by just pointing out the interpretation of the entropy condition. Of the entropy condition or entropy criterion, which, as we remember, we defined as phi of u t plus psi of u x smaller than one equals zero. And I mentioned this already, but I just wanted to write this down explicitly. So in physical applications, and we'll see this in the context of the Euler equations, phi of u will be thermodynamic entropy, and psi of u the entropy flux, and this is something you will show on future problem set. And so this means, this entropy condition means that entropy evolves according to its flux, so it can, it is sort of advected, but can also sharply increase due to shocks, but it cannot decrease. And so this encapsulates essentially the second law of thermodynamics, as I mentioned earlier. So just by itself, the conservation laws give rise to solutions that violate thermodynamics, and this entropy condition just makes sure that we pick the physically correct solution and add some additional information to the conservation laws that are not yet encoded in there. So I did go into quite some detail about these about the entropy condition and some of the results around this concept. And that is because obviously if we want a numerical scheme to find the correct physical solution, we need to make sure that it actually finds not just one sort of random weak solution to the problem, but that it actually picks the correct entropy solution. And this actually turns out to be a tricky problem numerically. And this is why one has to be careful when applying certain numerical schemes. So for example, some of the Godunov type schemes using approximate Riemann solvers don't necessarily pick out the entropy solution. And so one has to be very careful when applying those. So for example, the Rho solver, the so-called Rho approximate Riemann solver has problems finding sort of the picking out the entropy solution, while for example, the HLL solver, the HLL family of solvers can actually pick out the correct entropy solution. And so these are things that one has to be aware of, and that when will be actually discussing those schemes will actually pay some attention to. And so this is why I wanted to sort of introduce these entropy criteria and entropy solutions to some detail, as far as we will actually need it for the discrete limit. Okay, but I should probably stop here and rather move on. So in the very last part of today's lecture, I wanted to give a very brief primer on the Riemann problem that we'll discuss in more detail in the next few lectures, actually. And that will set the foundation for numerical schemes. And once we've understood essentially some aspects of the Riemann problem for nonlinear conservation laws and systems of nonlinear conservation laws, we can then finally move on and discuss conservative schemes to solve these systems of equations. So for now, we will specify the following problem. So we'll concentrate on the Riemann problem for scalar, but also for systems of conservation laws. And so this, as I already mentioned, is of the following form, where we look at solutions that have a discontinuity initially. So this is a sort of a two-state initial conditions where we have some constant solution UL to the left and some constant state UR, U right, for positive X to the right. So with UL and UR being constants. And so, as I already mentioned, the solution to this problem is actually more difficult than one might think naively. And it's really the centerpiece for numerical algorithms. So let me illustrate a few cases with the first example. And so I'll again invoke the example of the Invisibergus equation. So this is again just looking at the scalar conservation law case. And we'll have initial data again, UL and UR. And as we were mentioning early as well, this flux function leads to constant characteristic speeds, lambda prime of u, which is f double prime of u equals one. So that's an example for a convex flux function. Or a flux function that is convex everywhere on the domain. So let's look at a few examples that can arise depending on which values we choose for the initial constant states UL and UR. So the first case, let's say that UL is greater than UR, and this is what one would refer to as compressive data. So this would look like the following. So UL is lambda UL, which in this case is just UL. So F prime of UL equals UL. And this is by assumption greater than UR, which is characteristic speed lambda on the right, which we'll just denote by lambda R for now. And so the initial data would look like this. Let's say this is zero. And so we'll have some left state UR here and some right state, some left state UL here. Now, if we draw the characteristics to this, then we'll have some characteristics like this, originating on the negative domain. And then we'll have characteristics here with a smaller characteristic speed. So they will look like this here on the right-hand side. And as you can see here, these characteristics start to immediately cross for any t greater than zero. So unlike in the previous case where last time we looked at again at the Invested-Burgers equation, but for different initial data, where we smoothly sort of interpolated between these two states, between two constant states, one and zero. So there we had this wave steepening effect that only after some finite time led to the this wave breaking or this intersecting characteristics phenomenon. Here we'll actually have it right away. So this will lead to a discontinuity in the solution. Like here, maybe I can actually, let me again point this out here. So these would be the characteristics ending in this discontinuity, and those would be characteristics from the left-hand side, where here we have a constant solution state UL, and here constant state U right. And so this would be what we will call a shock. So a discontinuity sigma with a speed sigma prime of t equals s. So let's consider the Rankine Ugo-Neo jump conditions. So we know that the shock speed would be given by the flux evaluated on the left side of the shock minus the flux evaluated at the right side, divided by UL minus UR. which plugging in the expressions from the flux functions for the inverse Burger equation again leads us to this, which we've evaluated before. It's 1/2 u left plus u right. So you can actually write down a weak solution, u of x comma t equals u left and u right for x minus s t and greater than 0 and x minus s t. Oh, sorry, this is smaller than 0, greater than 0, I believe. And so from the Rankine-Ugonyot theorem, it follows that this would be a weak solution to the problem. It satisfies the initial data. It is piecewise differentiable on either side of the shock front. And now by construction, it satisfies the jump condition. So it follows that it's a weak solution. And also we have here the condition that the shock speed satisfies this relation. And we'll actually see that this is a special case of the so-called lax entropy condition, which will be a very useful criterion to select the entropy, the correct entropy solution in case of discontinuities in the solution, in the case of shocks being present in the solution. So this will be an even easier criterion for us to verify if we want to know whether a given weak solution is actually actually corresponds to the correct entropy solution. So this is essentially a primer on the lax entropy condition. And now let's consider the other case where UL is smaller than UR. So this is the case of expansive data. So here we have lambda characteristic speed on left, UL is smaller than characteristic speed on the right. So if I draw this solution, if one state here, this is U left, and here we have, say, x equals 0. Now again, we can draw those characteristics. I have something like this. And so one possibility here is for us to define the following weak solution, where we just define a discontinuity here in a similar way than above. Where the characteristics actually start from the discontinuity. And such a solution, so here we have the constant state UR, and here we have the constant state UL. So such a solution would be called a rarefaction shock, because the fluid is actually expanding away, just rarefying, so expanding away from this discontinuity. So the solution would be similar to the one above. One weak solution is the following, where S is one, again, 1/2 U left plus U right, and U of X comma T would be U left, U right, where X minus ST. Okay, but here, if we again look at the shock speed, UL smaller than S smaller than lambda right, so the characteristic speed on the left is smaller than the shock speed, which is again smaller than the characteristic speed on the right, and this will turn out to be the entropy violating solution, so an entropy violating shock. So here the discontinuity has not sort of arisen from an actual compression of the fluid, a convergence of characteristics into a discontinuity, but rather here the characteristics actually diverge from the discontinuity, and we'll show later that this actually violates the entropy condition. And this inequality here would therefore also violate the so-called lax entropy condition, which is a certain condition on the shock speed, certain inequality for the shock speed in terms of the characteristic speeds. Another possibility, however, for a weak solution is the following. So we're in the same setting. But now let's actually, instead of piecing these two constant solution regimes together with sort of a sharp discontinuity, let's try to actually let's try to match those with such a fan-like region in a continuous way. And so this is what we would call a centered rarefaction wave. So again, here we have a constant state UL, constant state U right. Then we have some fan-like solution in between here that continuously sort of interpolates between these two constant states. So here we simply introduce these sort of two domain boundaries. So we just connect these two constant states by another third state. So let's write down the following solution. Let's keep it constant for x over t smaller or equal than the characteristics be lambda l, and u of x comma t equals x divided by t in this fan-like region in the middle. And then to the right of this contact interface sigma 2, we'll have again the constant state u right. And this is what we call the centred reflection wave, which is also a nonlinear phenomenon. So that means that with larger values of the initial data, you not propagate faster than smaller values. So the wave actually spreads out and flattens over time. And so one can actually show that the solution here, so similar to the previous cases, one can analyze the Rankine-Ugonio jump conditions on both interfaces sigma 1 and sigma 2 and verify that both of them are satisfied. So this is also a weak solution to the problem. And one can also show that this solution actually satisfies the entropy condition. So we can write down the general solution to the Riemann problem for the Invissenberger's equation. So if we have compressive data, U left greater than UR, the entropy solution is given by this shock solution. Where the shock speed is 1/2 right state plus left state. And in our other case, where we have expansive initial data, sorry, did I write this wrong? No, we left smaller, yes. We have this three-state solution. And so finally, we've sort of pieced together in a fairly heuristic way the general solution to the Riemann problem of the Invissenberger equation, Berger's equation. And we've already discovered sort of the basic phenomenology of the Riemann problem, some of the general types of solutions one can expect, namely shock, compressive shock-like solutions. Then rarefaction shocks that violate the entropy condition, and rarefaction waves, all of which are nonlinear wave solutions. Now it turns out that if we look at more general scalar conservation laws, or in general then to systems of conservation laws, things become a little more complicated. So we'll need to introduce a little bit more machinery to actually sort of write down the Riemann, the general solution to the Riemann problem for sort of a general case that can be applied to any system of nonlinear conservation laws. And this is what we'll start with in the next lecture.